Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. If your home is your castle, hopefully it's created in a natural or planned garden setting. In this program, we will discuss the development and the expansion of homes, where they are, and why they came to be in the places they are, with Dolores Hayden, a professor of architecture and urbanism and American Studies at Yale University. In her book, Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000, Professor Hayden explores the design and the development of suburbs in the United States, from the 19th century utopian communities and elite picturesque enclaves to streetcar subdivisions and owner-built tracts, and to the post-war sitcom suburbs and subsidized malls and office parks that followed. When I spoke with Professor Hayden from her office at Yale University, we began by considering why people moved away from city life into what came to be called the suburbs.
I think a number of people back in the 1820s or 1830s would have believed that the cities were crowded and dirty, and it was quite difficult to separate oneself from one's workplace, so that sometimes the move to the suburbs was just justified as going outside the city to find a place that was a bit more quiet, a place where there would be a better connection to nature than in the city, and a better sense that there was a potential community that didn't include every single other urban resident.
Well, in the 1820s and 30s, were cities dangerous, as we would characterize some cities now?
I think that they were very different. They were small, so cities could have been the size of a kind of modest suburb today, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, relatively small, but very tightly packed, so that housing might be right next to shops, workshops, factories, right next to the port where the ships came in. Frequently, people lived in buildings where the business was on the ground floor, the owner of the business was on the next floor, and the employees were on the top floor. There was very little either horizontal or vertical separation. People had to get around by walking, and so, or they might have been using horse and cart or a carriage. It was crowded in a way that we would find it hard to imagine now.
Well, how about the public health considerations at that time?
Well, those early cities lacked many of the things we might take for granted, such as system of sewers. And so they also were pretty commonly subject to epidemics of disease. And some of the people who left the city and thought that they would commute back in were probably hoping that they could raise their children in a healthier atmosphere.
Was that actually what happened?
Sometimes I think it was better to be 45 minutes or so outside of the city. But what happened as the 19th century progressed is that people thought about designing suburbs very particularly to make them healthy. And so one of the famous residential suburbs in New Jersey, Llewellyn Park, was actually developed by a man who was a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and he'd made his money selling patent medicine, and then he wanted to make a healthy suburb as a model for the rest of the U.S. It was a very large and extravagant plan that he developed, and people had extremely large lots. Most of the people who went to the healthy suburb were very wealthy indeed.
In your book, Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth for 180 Years Preceding 2000, you talk about seven developing styles in suburbs. Can you tell us about those?
The first was the borderland, and that's what we've been talking about. People who went one by one to the outskirts of the city. Sometimes they bought a farm and tried to convert that into a suburban estate. But the second stage, the picturesque enclave, was typified by something like Llewellyn Park, New Jersey. Architect and a landscape architect would design the entire community, and then people would build their houses within a site plan that included a lot of shared public space for people within the community. So the enclave is really the second type. And then after that, comes this wonderful moment when people think that there can be a working class version of suburban life, and people start the streetcar build-outs. And all over the country where there are streetcar lines after about 1870, there are people subdividing lots and building 1, 2, and 3 family houses and mom-and-pop shops with apartments above them, which are the suburbs for the masses. And many, many people begin to enjoy having a little green space next to their housing. And many people in this streetcar phase also get to live very close to their relatives. It may be that the mom and dad own the building, and then they have elderly parents or children and their spouses right there in the same building. So it provides a kind of tight community. And we see streetcar suburbs outside city centers all over the U.S., although sometimes people don't recognize them as suburbs. Sometimes they think of them as the old neighborhood or the family neighborhood from about 1910, 1920. And then after that, there's a phase of self-building where people try to do the suburban house from scratch. And the self-built suburbs provide some of the cheapest suburban housing, but they get pretty confusing. And they're not always well-planned. They don't always have paved streets or electric light or sewers. Sometimes developers are just selling so many thousands of lots, they don't take any time or money to put some adequate infrastructure in. So after these self-built suburbs, where there are also some people with mail-order houses trying to get their houses together, well, really, there's a lot of federal legislation, and there's regulation to a certain extent. There's federal financing, and subsidies begin to go in for a national American suburban lifestyle, which we finally see in the 1940s after World War II. And that's the moment when many, many people who are thinking about how they will live after World War II get a mortgage and head out to a suburban development like Levittown outside of New York City. And Levittown is so highly publicized that people all over the country begin building similar developments.
That was also a time when there was a tremendous migration to California and other Western states.
Yes, that's right. And when the migration comes from the South, and there are African-American workers looking for jobs in the war plants, say, there's a sort of expectation that all of the veterans and all of the war plant workers will get some kind of decent housing when the war is over. Because during the war, housing was in short supply. Frequently, people were living in trailers or very makeshift accommodations. After the war, though, what is very upsetting and disappointing and has great importance for American cities is that the federal government will not provide mortgage insurance on subdivisions that have people of color in them along with whites. And so the Levittowns and the Lakewoods become almost entirely white communities of new small houses, affordable houses, but they segregate the city in a way which we're still trying to recover from. And women are also not given credit to purchase houses in that era. It's thought that both women and people of color are bad credit risks. And so it's a very reactionary time. And through the 40s and early 50s, older people and female-headed families and women of color are still trying to deal with whatever housing is available in the inner city, while white male-headed families go to those other suburbs. I have called them the sitcom suburbs because those suburbs seem to have all kinds of similar families with the white male breadwinner, the woman who's abandoned her wartime job to raise a family and 2 or 3 kids. And, of course, all of the situation comedies on television that begin in the 40s and 50s seem to echo that very same kind of life. And people feel the rest of America disappears before this image of a popular sitcom suburb.
Within that dynamic, can you comment on the structural or the architectural styles of American housing and how they change to accommodate the women in the role of primarily doing the domestic work and other aspects?
It's fascinating to see that the Levitt houses are really just another version of what Sears had been selling as a traditional Cape Cod house through the 20s and the 30s. And, of course, these traditional Cape Cod houses were built up on Cape Cod in Massachusetts in the 18th century. Levitt begins to produce a single plan, and then thousands of houses on this plan are sold. The Cape Cod is a two-bedroom house. It's a very small 700 or 800 square foot house. It's got a kitchen, a living room, a bathroom, and 2 bedrooms. But Levitt wants to make it a little more exciting. So he begins to advertise that he's got a Bendix washing machine in this little house. And then he puts an Admiral television inside and builds it into the wall of the living room so that the houses seem to be modern in a way since they have these appliances. Then he goes on to develop a ranch house, which is still a two-bedroom house, but it's slightly less traditional in its styling. The ranch house has a carport. The Cape Cod had a driveway but no garage, and it had space for the homeowner to do a little weekend carpentry and expand it. The ranch is the second Levitt design after the Cape Cod. It actually turns the living room to the backyard, and it begins to make more of the backyard as a place for family activities. So there's some suggestion that maybe a housewife will like the new arrangement. She'll be able to be in her kitchen, looking out at the street, watching her kids playing. It's, however, pretty disappointing in terms of what women had thought about during World War II as the future of housing.
What were those thoughts?
At that time, there were child care centers. There were arrangements that were made for the Rosie the Riveters as valued workers, which made it much, much more comfortable for them to be in their families doing nurturing and also connected to the possibilities of public life and paid work. And so the Levitt House really in many ways is a step backward. It's not so unlike what people would have experienced in the picturesque enclaves 100 years earlier. It's a basic kitchen, and the woman is in there alone.
There's also another aspect going on, I think, and that's after World War II, where people would, to a much greater extent, purchase food and clothing as opposed to produce it for themselves. So they become, by families, much more insular and much more dependent on supplied goods and services.
Well, I think that's something that starts to happen in the second half of the 19th century. As people move away from rural life, women will be doing less of the spinning and weaving, and they'll be buying more canned goods. So there's a long period of transition. If you're in a rural area in the early 20th century, you might still be doing your own canning, and maybe you'll be doing some sewing, but you're probably not doing too much weaving. Those kinds of activities have moved to factories, and people are going to town in the car to buy things in the general store, even in a rural area, that they wouldn't have been able to get, say, in 1830 or 1840. So by 1950, people are going to think about, can they get to a shopping mall? And after the big federal subsidies for the sitcom suburbs, there comes a moment when there are federal subsidies for shopping malls and all kinds of commercial property, and those really form what we call the edge nodes or edge cities, commercial districts located on the intersections of highways and arterials outside of existing suburbs.
In addition to providing housing for the people of America at that time, do you know or have an opinion if there was another intention on the part of the federal government in designing the kinds of housing that they were willing to subsidize?
Well, that's a good question. And in my book, I cover the debates that ranged from the 1920s to the 1950s about whether or not there should be any multifamily housing in America, or whether we should become a nation that was predominantly a nation of single-family houses. And there were many advocates in the 20s and the 30s of planned towns and public housing that included perhaps three-story buildings with various kinds of apartments for families and community facilities connected to those buildings, including some shopping and recreational facilities like swimming pools. And there had been some very good projects of this kind built in the 20s and the 30s. But the opposite was proposed by real estate developers who were involved with the Department of Commerce in the 20s and 30s and wanted to be able to subdivide large tracts of land and sell private houses to individual families. And these two lobbies, the lobby for public housing in planned towns and the lobby for private housing, battled it out through the 20s and the 30s. And in the late 40s, they were still struggling over this. And by that time, Senator Joseph McCarthy was on the side of the real estate developers. And he thought that any kind of multifamily housing was breeding ground for communists. So there was a good deal of red baiting that went on. And in the end, I think we'd have to say that American neighborhoods lost out because we didn't build planned towns. We didn't build sound neighborhoods. We financed through the government, through people's tax subsidies on their mortgages, and through government insurance for private developers. We financed tens of millions of single-family houses that were situated without much connection to public transportation or to any kind of community facilities. And we're still struggling with this now. What the government then went on to do was to build highways rather than public transportation. And that brings us to a place where there are, I think it's 137 million automobiles in the United States these days and about 92 million trucks. And we have remade a lot of our landscape for the passage of these cars and trucks rather than for the comfortable pedestrian life of ordinary people.
Let's talk about the politics that went into building these roads, and perhaps you can begin with the interstate highway system that President Eisenhower advocated in the 50s.
The story of the interstate highway system is absolutely fascinating. It really started before 1956. The legislation was signed in 56, but there was a group of over 200 lobbyists who met all during World War II to think about how roads might be expanded in the country when the war was over. And those lobbyists were called the Road Gang. They represented paving interests, petroleum, rubber. They represented truckers, and they also would have included people involved in real estate, asphalt, construction, highway engineers. It was quite a large group of people. And they met all through World War II and through the late 40s, advocating a 42,000-mile national highway system. They had some opposition at first. In fact, there were railroad interests, and the railroads had moved most of the war material during World War II, so we still had quite a big railroad system functioning well in the 40s. But the automobile people and the truck people and the bus people wanted to see the end of the railroads. They wanted to see the end of streetcars, too, and the rise of a nation where every family had at least one car. They managed to finally craft a bill, which Eisenhower is willing to sign, which said that the roads would be constructed with 90% federal money and 10% state money. And then what they did was to give each state highway department the power to do the roads in that state. And so from having one national road gang, which was a very, very powerful lobby, we came to have a road gang in every single state capital. And those people, who were highway engineers primarily, decided where they were going to locate the roads and how fast they would build them. In many cases, they drove those roads through older downtowns, frequently through the neighborhoods that were inhabited by people of color or poor people who didn't have the political influence to resist. And then they stretched the roads out beyond existing suburbs, creating a great deal of new accessibility for greenfield real estate. And so suburbs doubled and tripled in size with the arrival of those interstate highways. People went farther and farther out. And then the government made one more subsidy for this greenfield commercial real estate that fitted very well with the highway subsidies. And we began to get malls and office parks at the exits from these interstate highways. And pretty soon, there were so many new jobs in those malls and office parks that downtowns were suffering, not just suffering from the construction of those freeways that had destroyed certain neighborhoods, but suffering from the loss of jobs. Downtowns were really beginning to seem weaker than some of those new commercial districts that were rather placeless, not designed for pedestrians, but somehow or other had captured a lot of our country's economic activity.
Well, where is all of this going now? From what you describe with the big box stores and the malls at every interstate exit, America looks the same regardless of where a person might be viewing it.
I think it's true. I think that if you were standing in one of these edge nodes in Maine, you'd be hard-pressed to say that you were not in Florida or Texas or California or Michigan. Some of this is just being cranked out across the country.
I guess there's two questions. One, why is it happening this way? And two, where do you see it going?
It's happening this way because people who may work in these edge nodes frequently decide they'd like to live in a more quiet and unspoiled place. And so at 5 o'clock, they jump in the car and drive further out from the older downtown areas to the very edge of a metropolitan region or beyond it, looking for this triple dream of shelter and nature and community. So we find that in the U.S. right now, the fastest growing places are the rural fringes, and that's my seventh type of suburb. But it isn't successful growth because it isn't well planned, and frequently small rural communities are overwhelmed by people who want to buy farmland, and small towns are overwhelmed by new residents who simply don't understand that the quality of the small town they're moving to, the very things that appeal to them so much, sidewalks and face-to-face communication, will be destroyed if one pours another 10,000 cars into that very delicate existing small town environment. And so I'd say we're in a situation right now where Americans have abandoned older suburbs year after year and keep on trying to build new ones, but we can't afford to do this. We can't throw away our older towns and older suburbs. So we have to go back and take stock of what places we have that are livable and strengthen them rather than continuously looking for new growth.
Well, that's a philosophical or perhaps an academic interpretation. How does that fit against the two aspects? One, the commercial desire to continue to pave and build, and two, the burgeoning population.
I think that the burgeoning population is not necessarily a population that wants to live 100 miles out of the older town downs. I think that we're in a place where when people need to get to work, they don't want to sit in the car for 2 hours. They might like to be located near public transportation so that they could have a more manageable workday.
Or even above the store, like it used to be.
I think so. And I think that suggests that there needs to be a lot of infill in older neighborhoods, and a lot of careful consideration of how to improve our public transportation. Otherwise, we get to a place which is simply unsustainable. And I'm not sure that's an academic viewpoint. It seems to me that when things are unsustainable, it means that we simply can't manage to keep on using up land, using up water, stretching out our days, commutes. People come to a place where it just can't happen anymore.
Yet we are. If we look at the federal regulations that are being altered in terms of clean air and clean water and some land use controls and zoning controls, that appears to be happening.
I think we're in a time when a lot of communities have recognized that they need to put some limits on growth. And so we have a whole movement for wise growth and fair growth, growth that is going to be positive in terms of people's lives and jobs rather than growth that is sprawl or exaggerates inequalities. On the other hand, it does seem to me that there are certain things happening now in the U.S. under the current administration that are very unwise. Big new subsidies in the current energy bill. Sometimes it seems to me we have a big debate between people who understand that we need to put constraints on our settlement planning and do it more wisely and build for the longer term, and people who think that it is better to simply look for more oil, look for more resources around the world, conduct foreign wars if necessary, just to assure that the American consumer is going to have a supply of inexpensive gasoline to run those automobiles down those highways. And so I think these are two very, very different points of view about the economy, about democracy. And these are going to be very important issues in the next 10 years or so.
Dolores Hayden, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you would recommend or a book that you've read lately.
I love Liz Cohen's book called A Consumer's Republic, which is about the making of American consumption a popular activity. It deals with the middle of the 20th century. And it's a very engaging book that goes into a lot of wonderful detail about the rise of the shopping mall and the ways in which people try to connect a public life to this activity of consuming things, buying things, cars, furniture, clothes. I think it provides a terrific insight into the ways we have understood consumer behavior in this country. And it also traces an earlier tradition from the 30s when consumers organizations were not so much about getting people down to the mall as about thinking much more about what it would mean for Americans to be able to have adequate food and shelters. It's a very different 1930s kind of consumerist movement that she traces, as well as the mall-type activity of the 50s.
There are more women architects now than there were 30 years ago.
Yes.
Substantially more, like in all of the professions.
That's right. That's right.
So how would architecture and the planning of housing been different had there been more women architects in those periods of time?
That's a great question. And it seems to me that if you look at the work of someone like Catherine Bauer, who was a wonderful housing activist in the 1930s and 40s, someone who wrote the public housing legislation, the Wagner Act in 1937, along with another woman called Edith Elmer Wood, they had a vision of many families living together in really well-planned communities. They had a vision of the government constructing housing through perhaps local co-ops, nonprofit corporations, not necessarily through public housing agencies, but through a variety of local community groups. They had a vision of government subsidies that would produce much, much more socially connected kinds of residential communities. And I think had they prevailed in the 50s, we would have seen many more housing choices, ways that people who were older and younger could live in the same communities. We would have seen a much better kind of social and racial integration. And I think that they also would have supported the work of architects like Eleanor Raymond, who had that solar house developed in New England, working with an MIT scientist, Dr. Maria Telkis. In the late 40s, they had a working solar house. And the reason it didn't get replicated across the U.S. was that builders saw no reason to increase the cost of a building because eventually the buyers would be paying the utility bills. So not only did they not want to bother with the solar house, they weren't even going to bother to put in much insulation. And then, of course, 30 years later, there's an energy crisis, and we talk about whether or not we can retrofit our houses. But this technical solution was there as soon as Eleanor Raymond and Dr. Telkis were working on things. Those are the sorts of architects and planners who would have made a great difference had they been more mainstream.
Dolores Hayden, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Dolores Hayden is the author of Building Suburbia, Green Fields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000. The book she recommends is A Consumer's Republic by Liz Cohen. Thanks to Neil Bell for his editorial and technical assistance in the production of this edition of Radio Curious. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.